is first necessary to kind of tell the people that there is no soul, something like that. This is a Mahayana sutra. There are three or four Mahayana sutras there.
Okay.
Now, so this Om Mani Padme Hum may very well be a reference to the psychic being, but if you ask the Buddhists, they will deny it. Even those who practice it, I mean, that mantra.
Mm.
Oh, wait a minute, I think Mary Louise Stone is calling. Hold on.
Thank you.
So, shall we begin reading the next paragraph then? Devasudha, I think you're on hold right now.
Okay.
So, I can start.
Sure.
This slow development can be aided by the mind's clear perception and insistence on something within that survives the death of the body and effort to know its nature. But at first, this knowledge is impeded by the fact that there are many elements in us, many formations which present themselves as soul elements and can be mistaken for the psyche. In the early Greek and some other traditions about the afterlife, the descriptions given show very clearly that what was then mistaken for the soul was a subconscious formation, a sub-physical impression mold or shadow form of the being, or as a wraith or ghost of the personality. This ghost, which is mistakenly called the spirit, is sometimes a vital formation reproducing the man's characteristics, his surface life mannerisms, sometimes a subtle physical prolongation of the surface form of the mind shell. At best, it is a sheath of the life personality which still remains in the front of for some time after the departure from the body. Apart from these confusions born of an after-death contact with discarded phantasms or remnants of the sheets of the personality, the difficulty is due to our ignorance of the subliminal parts of our nature and the form and powers of the conscious being or Purusha which preside over their action. Owing to this inexperience, we can easily mistake something of the inner mind or vital self for the psychic. For as being is one, yet multiple, so also the same law prevails in ourselves and our members. The spirit, the Purusha, is one, but it adapts itself to the formations of nature. Over each grade of our being, a power of the spirit presides. We have within us, and discover when we go deep enough inwards, a mind self, a life self, a physical self. There is a being of mind, a mental Purusha, expressing something of itself on our surface in the thoughts, perceptions, activities of our mind nature, a being of life which expresses something of itself in the impulses, feelings, sensations, desires, external life activities of our vital nature, a physical being, a being of the body which expresses something of itself in the instincts, habits, formulated activities of our physical nature. These beings or part selves of the self in us are the powers of the spirit and therefore not limited by their temporary expression. For what is thus formulated is only a fragment of its possibilities. But the expression creates a temporary mental, vital or physical personality which grows and develops even as the psychic being or soul personality grows and develops within us. Each has its own distinct nature, its influence, its action on the whole of us. But on our surface, all these influences and all this action, as they come up, mingle and create an aggregate surface being which is a composite, an amalgam of them all, an outer persistent and yet shifting and mobile formation for the purposes of this life and its limited experience.
So, actually to, you know, just bring to our mind the previous paragraph also and lead to this, he's basically talking about the fact that at the level of an individual human being, the evolution becomes individually conscious through the formation of a soul personality or psychic being. That is one of the first, you know, I mean, critical points for that which is universal and seems to be automatic, a process of prakriti or nature, universal or cosmic nature, comes into the ambit of a conscious and individual process. So that we can say that there is some kind of handle we have on the process of evolution. So this soul personality is closely connected with the sense of conscious individuality in the human being. This is partly the reason why he's pointing to a number of factors by which human beings become aware of this soul personality. One of them is this sense of something which persists. Something persists the coming and going of the body. That there is a certain kind of thing in us to which death is alien. That is one. Then there is the sense of independent ideals, high noble ideals that human beings have, that seem to have an independent origination. They are not necessarily something which, you know, the roots of ethics is not just a pragmatic convenience, but seems to have some absolute basis, and this is something which is related to some part in us which responds to some supreme reality that has these characteristics. Thirdly, there is the emergence of the fullness of self, a sense of personhood and sense of self which has not appeared to that extent in nature before the coming of the human being. So as a result, we seek for this center. This is a very interesting thing because in a way, whether we take it in terms of something individual that responds to the supreme realities, or we take it as something which persists beyond death, or we take it as a sense of self which is primordial, we have our first intimation of something we may call the soul. An idea of a soul personality or psychic being is that not merely is the soul some kind of essence or spark, but that it has some control over the rest of the nature, that it has a shape, a form, a kind of mentality, vitality, and physicality. So, in fact, some of the schools approach the soul in a variety of ways like this. I was recently reading how Ramana Maharshi constantly pointed to the meditation of the origin of the sense of I. Whatever people asked, he would point to that. That ask yourself, who is the asker? Who is the person asking these questions? Who is the true source of the I? The sense of individuality and personhood that has arisen, where is its origin? That contemplation in its fullness can also bring us into contact with the soul. But this soul would be a self, a primordial inner self, antaratman, that in a sense does not need to have the personality that the psychic being has in terms of its operational possibilities. So here, if we try to assume that there is some kind of deep soul within us, with this sort of form that has mentality, vitality, physicality, etc. in its own time, then we arrive at certain difficulties. This is what Sri Aurobindo is dealing with over here. Is that we can assume it, but it is not so easy of access. So the paragraph read earlier last time points to two major difficulties in accessing this. One is that the psychic being as a soul personality itself evolves. It starts off in a rather rudimentary fashion. It doesn't have sufficient amount of presence in our nature. Secondly, it expresses itself through the nature instruments, speak for it. And in speaking for it, distort it both in content and in vibration, in modality. Because it's as if the language of the mind, the language of the vital, the language of the physical already imposes certain kinds of distortions to the language of the psychic being. Secondly, the message of the psychic being in its translation through these instruments gets changed as a message as well. So both, in both cases, were we to be even as pure as possible, as receptive as possible to its messages, still the mind would cast the, you know, the stuff of mind into the expression of the psyche. Now, so that's the second major problem. The problem that the lack of transformation of the inner nature lends its own difficulties to the transmission of the psychic being. The third problem is we're not even sufficiently in contact with the inner mind, inner vital, inner physical complex. We are a surface personality. And in the surface personality, it's like, you know, there was another teacher, Gurdjieff, who gave the analogy of the house in which there is no master. The master has died. And in its place, there's a bunch of different kind of functionaries. A cook, a driver, a gardener, various kinds of functionaries, a nurse, who open the door whenever they happen to be close to the door. And to whoever comes, they claim that they are the master. This is the situation of the surface personality, where all these influences jostle for identity. So this is the complexity, operational complexity, due to which the psychic being is not available to us. In this paragraph, he points to the other approach. How can we contact this? By directing our gaze towards some property of it. And here he brings up that primary property that he has introduced earlier. In this chapter, Sri Aurobindo introduces the most primordial property of the psychic being as that in it which outlasts every mutation of the body. That is, life and death, there's nothing to it. It outlasts the death of the body and passes from life to life. Now, if this intuition is made use of, and that's how he starts this paragraph, that otherwise we are left subject to nature's evolution. We have to say that psychic being will emerge someday, but in the meantime we just have to wait patiently for it. From life to life we just need to wait. On the other hand, he ends that previous paragraph by saying that it's possible to introduce a conscious process into this nature's process so as to bring it to the front. Now, how can we do that? That's what he's considering here. So he's saying one way to do that is to put our attention on this problem, on this property, that the soul outlasts death. And he's saying that there are some problems with that as well. The problem is, that what do we take to be that in us which outlasts them? And this essentially boils down to an ignorance of the topography of nature, of individual human nature. We don't have any sense of that very complex geography, or whatever you want to call it, topography of the subjective being. So Sri Aurobindo says, first, we try to think that whatever exceeds the life of the body is what we call the ghost. What is the ghost? And so here he looks at certain Greek perceptions of, because the Greeks believed in transmigration, but often for them transmigration was basically the passage of the vital being from one body to another. And when we were dealing with the philosophy of rebirth, he brought this up and we considered this to some extent. But here he is actually looking at this persistence beyond death as one of the temporary sheaths, either the remnant of a mind image of the physical or the vital, with some of the characteristics of the physical life, which stays back in the physical atmosphere or subtle physical atmosphere. So if that becomes our notion of that which outlasts death, then we've captured only a very thin fringe of the life of the inner being. If we were to overcome that and go deeper, he says that also there is a problem, because we are not clearly aware of the mental, vital, physical complex that stands in front of the psychic being. That indeed each of us has a separate mind, a separate life being, and a separate physical being, subtle physical being, and a physical being that we are conscious of, that we can see, hear, touch, smell, taste, etc. That this inner self, this objective self, is made up of this complexity. And each one of these parts has got its independent reality. This is the part with regard to Indian psychology that Sri Aurobindo brings up. And it forms a peculiar kind of difficulty if one were not to know it. This is actually one of the major difficulties with trying to arrive at an empirical psychology. Empirical psychology would mean, by studying behavior, by studying reactions, we arrive at some kind of a description of the psychology. But such a description would hardly be able to tap into the profundities of the roots of psychology. For that, one has to explore the nature with a hypothesis in hand. And this is the hypothesis, and this has been the Indian method. The Indian method has been, hypothesis is provided to us by those who have actually had certain experiences and have formulated it in a certain manner for us to individually explore whether that particular truth can be validated or not. I think Sitaram has come on the line.
Yeah, I'll just add.
So here he's talking about the three selves, the mind self, the life self, and the physical self. These three selves are triple purushas. And here he's pointing out very beautifully how it is that Purusha is one, but Purusha in its manifestation takes its station behind every possibility or modality of expression. Therefore, coming into the nature, it retains its primordial sort of station in the soul realm. But it also enters into every one of the other expressive possibilities of nature, physical, vital, and mental, and becomes the being there. Okay, the mental purusha, the vital purusha, physical purusha are the real being, the being of mind, the being of life, and the being of the body are these. Now these beings therefore have an independent reality. The way he describes it is so beautiful, because he points out that each of them, being actually a perspective of the purusha, has infinite potential. It is not that the mental purusha is limited to being only mental. In some way, the mental purusha is the true purusha. So is the vital purusha. So is the physical purusha. But it is accessible only through mind. That's where the inextricable web of purusha and prakriti exists. In that, being accessible only through mind, it's form to us is one that is given through the subliminal mind, or in the case of life, the subliminal life being, the subliminal subtle physical being. And these aspects, under the control of the purusha, are also evolving. So we have an inner mind personality, an inner life personality, an inner physical personality, along with the soul personality, each one of which is evolving independently. Now this independent evolution leads to a tremendous difficulty because we tend to take any aspect of any one of these to be ourselves. Even when we really start searching for a true self, we often end up just empowering one or the other creative persons. Often have a much more powerful sense of self than what run-of-the-mill people are given to have because of their conditioning. A creative person is more expressive in some original fashion, which evidences the operation of some kind of Purusha. And yet this Purusha could be either mental Purusha, vital Purusha, physical Purusha, or combination thereof. And we could be pretty happy thinking this is really our self, you know, I'm in contact with the self, the true self. But it is only when we have a clear idea of the depth of nature that we can go beyond that.
Devajishna, could you repeat what you said about what Sri Aurobindo says are the difficulties with, you know, figuring out or conceptualizing a part in us that is deathless, and then trying to work on that conceptualization and make it real. Isn't that what you said?
Yeah, what I said was that in this paragraph, he's going beyond what we proposed in the previous paragraph.
Yeah,
basically,
yeah.
There are problems because there's not sufficient evolution of the soul, or there are other things that are speaking for the soul. So he's saying we must use the power of attention. This is what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
We have to use the power of attention to bring it to the front. So what kind of power of attention are we going to use? What are we going to be attentive to? So here he is drawing on that first property of the soul that he introduced earlier, that the soul is the deathless part in us. If there is some sense that there is something in us which is deathless, let's extract that from the complexity of our personalities. So he says, what do we have any idea? What is that? And he's pointing to the various difficulties of extracting that, various mistakes we may make on the way. First, we may take this ghostly personality to be that part. Then we may take any of these evolving personalities which have a life of its own to be that part. Only beyond that, if we overcome those particular mistaken identities, can we touch the true part which is truly beyond life and death. One of its signs is that, you know, that's why in the Veda it is called Jata Veda. Jata Veda means knower of births. That is one of its, you know, kind of birth signs. The fact that the experience of the psychic being brings the notion of past births, brings the idea that this has existed in many lives before and will exist in many lives after or forever. Never, there is no sense of a beginning or an end to the successions of lives that this has taken. So that is the hem of the eternal that one has to touch to know that it is truly the psychic being one has got to. Otherwise, one can touch a variety of other things and think that that is the deathless part.
In fact, you have already mentioned, but I still wanted to phrase in my language that, you know, this since all our nature parts, almost it feels like, and it's just the way I perceive it, it feels like they almost become non-existent if there is no absolute influence of the psyche. I mean, at least to the perception, not in reality. So, I mean, it is very tricky in the practical sadhana, I mean, that looking at some psychic, which is actually coming from a psychic influence, but then it gets mixed up with the ego part, with the nature part, and that mixing is something which is the problem. Then it starts like, like encashing that psychic influence as something to convince myself that, well, this is a psychic or it is pure. And then that way, giving the passage to all the impure parts as well. I mean,
yeah, no doubt. That absolutely, that is exactly how it happens. And in fact, actually, what you're saying, this mixture is, I think you began very well also by saying that it is really the psychic that gives the sense of identity to any other nature part. It's really deriving it from there. And what he's pointing out here is the complexity of that that identification. That not only is there what we call the ego at the surface, but there are also true personalities that are not the ego and yet not the psychic being. Mental Purusha, Vital Purusha, and Physical Purusha are not ego, because they actually they are channels of the Supreme Purusha, but they are operating at a certain level, which is not the psychic level, and so they're limited in their ability to, you know, the personality that they can transform, or that they can talk to or talk for is extremely limited. This is where Sri Aurobindo is going to introduce the notion of the central being, which is another very important idea that he talks of, which is that the ego is the distortion in surface nature of this particular deepest Purusha, the psychic being. But the sense of self, which is already partially determined in each of us, is coming from some amalgam of mental, vital, physical activity that has behind it one of these pushers that stands in front of the psychic being. So that becomes the central being in us. Now, I have a certain sense of it. Again, these are reading between the lines, because Sri Aurobindo has not, as I have read, it's possible, because I have not read everything, even in what has been published. And then there is a lot that has not been published. So the idea of the central being, I have thought often, has something to do with the notion of Swabhava and Swadharma. Swabhava and Swadharma ultimately come from the psychic being. But nevertheless, it operates to some extent through what he is calling the central being. Central being gives that stamp of individual expression to us. Now, stamp of individual expression, however, can be made much more flexible and ultimately can disappear if the psychic being comes to the front. Then it is a natural action of the psychic being, and this predominance of one part of the Purusha, is the mental, vital or physical, is transcended. See, but before that, we take one of those to be ourself, as it were, and that's why it stands in the way of the psychic being.
In fact, these words are very, again, this Swabhava and Swadharma, these words are, in a way, can be very, misused also. Because, somebody, say, an engineer and did some programming or whatever and starts thinking that, my Swabhava is Buddhi or whatever. I mean, I'm just saying, like, giving a very rough example.
No, no doubt. Not only is it, it can be, it is. In fact, the first level of misunderstanding that took place in India and exists to a large extent to this day is that Swabhava is part of the caste system. Okay. Swadharma is the caste system. That if you are born a Kshatriya, then that is an, many interpretations of the Gita take that particular line. That what Krishna is saying to Arjuna is that you were born a Kshatriya, therefore that's your Swadharma. Then in modern times, it's what you said, which is very, very possible and happens a lot. We are actually the slaves of the determinisms of our upbringing, and various other kinds of circumstantial forces make us do certain things, and that forms a certain kind of conscience in us. And that conscience makes us say, this is my Swadharma. But that may not have anything to do with the psychic determination within. So I completely agree, it's a very dangerous idea unless one really takes it spiritually and goes to the root of it.
So the Swabhava and Swadharma are properties of which part of the being?
Ultimately, they are properties of the psychic being, but they also act through what Sri Aurobindo calls the central being. It's the confusion of the central being that is part of the yoga sadhana of the integral yoga, this first of the three transformations. And that's partly what he's talking about now. I think in the next few paragraphs, he'll bring it out much more clearly that either mental purusha, vital purusha, or physical purusha takes the appearance of the central being. Therefore, that kind of prakriti starts ruling the nature. But actual central being is the psychic being. So there has to be an effort of the identity to shift from one of these purushas, where it is predominant, to a psychic being. This is, in fact, again, going back to my reading of Gita, this is why I feel the Gita's message is an evolutionary one in the individual sense. It proceeds from a certain kind of central being to the psychic being, in saying that we must start with our Swadharma in making whatever kind of yoga sort of approach, one of the triple paths of the Gita. According to the Swadharma, you must make your beginning. But we must end by making a wholesale surrender, integral surrender to the divine, which is only possible by the psychic being. So replacing the central, firstly we have to cut through the ego. Secondly, we have to get to the central being. Thirdly, we have to replace the central being by the psychic being. Make that the true central being. So that is the transition. In a way, if one can make the psychic come to the front right in the beginning, there's nothing like it. But this is the practical difficulty that intervenes, in that we already have a certain predominance of one of the purushas. Actually, firstly, a certain predominance of one of the prakritis, and that is because one of the purushas stands as the central being.
Devashishta, so a broad classification of Swabhava is it translates to gunas or is it translates to chaturvarnas? Which one is it, basically? What is the broad classification of what? Suppose, irrespective of your vocation, you are of the nature, spiritually speaking, like you are, for you, surrender is more prominent in you. Like, can you think of that as the Swabhava? What are the classifications of Swabhava?
Yeah, it is not the gunas, Sitas. Gunas have to do with prakriti. Swabhava has to do with Purusha. Swadharma has to do with also psychic being, but the expressive part. We may say, using some terminology I've used earlier, psychic being itself has Purusha and Prakriti aspects to it. Purusha aspect of psychic being yields Swabhava. Prakriti aspect of psychic being yields Swadharma. Law of becoming. But these acts through the central being. In other words, therefore, the action is going to take place. Mind you, what he's calling soul personality is a kind of a kind of interaction between psychic entity and inner nature. So, mental, vital, physical complex, as the psychic being is formed through interacting with it, develops a certain predominance, and that is through which this Swabhava and Swadharma express themselves. So, Swabhava belongs to psychic Purusha that expresses through the Purusha of mind, life, or body, which is the central being. And Swadharma belongs to psychic Prakriti, which expresses through the Prakriti of one of these Purushas. But if we come to the root of Swabhava and Swadharma, which is the psychic being, there Swabhava and Swadharma become much more flexible than what we understand. In fact, one becomes free of any determinism of Swabhava and Swadharma. There seem to be free choices of the psychic being. And as a free choice, the psychic being can then do other things with the expression, just as in that previous paragraph, mind you, he was saying, one of those things he was saying, it was very, that previous paragraph was also very powerful, because there he was saying, I just read that part. I think this is the part where he's saying, for the road is as yet ill-built, easily obstructed, the wires often cut or crowded with communications of another kind, proceeding from another origin. Its power to impress what it receives upon the outer instruments is also imperfect. In its penury, it has for most things to rely on these instruments and its forms, and it forms its push to expression and action on their data and not solely on the unerring perceptions of the psychic entity. This it over here is the psychic being, mind you. He's saying the psychic being, when our identity is there and it's not strong enough, is actually to some extent having to depend on the nature to express itself, and can't go back to the psychic entity to freely determine its expression. So the Swabhava and Swadharma idea, so long as there isn't a full identification with the psychic being, we are to some extent the slave of Swabhava and Swadharma. Only to the extent that we come into contact with an identity with psychic being, we realize that Swabhava and Swadharma are a free choice of the psychic being that can also bring other powers into expression, because it's in full contact with the psychic entity, which is the freedom and infinity of God.
Devashish, what is penury?
Penury is poverty.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, actually, this is a very good, this, if we think that it is a free choice, after all, then we know that that is a free choice for everyone, right? And then there is no, nothing so great about having buddhi versus service or whatever. I mean, there is no, discrimination from that point of view anymore. It is a differentiation, not a discrimination.
Yeah, now Swabhava and Swadharma, yeah, it is a differentiation, but ultimately there is no hierarchy to the discrimination because it is a free choice from the depths. But we don't experience it like that, though we may say so. That's the reason why it's so important to actually come to that. Otherwise, that deformation will remain.
And also, I was thinking another thing is this, psychic being is something that survives death. I right. So, hello? Yeah. So, having that said, this Sabhava and Sadharma also survives death?
No, you see, Sabhava and Sadharma survives death only in the sense that it is a certain kind of soul expression. But soul expression, since it is based on, it's got its base in psychic entity, can continue to change, you see. Sabhava and Swadharma is being expressed by the soul personality. Soul personality can continue to bring new things into itself.
So this can be thought of as something that psychic being chose for a particular lifetime. Just like where it is born and all that it chooses. Similarly, right?
Yeah, but it may even be a number of lifetimes, or it may be brought back into the lifetime later. Basically, you're right that it is not necessarily something fixed for all lifetimes, because ultimately it is the development of an integral personality which is the aim of the psychic being. So it's expressing something now, bringing other things behind it. But later it may change the equation because it's doing so in its freedom.
This is what is called karma, right? The propensities, the swabhavas. In other religions, maybe Buddhism, that's what they call this baggage of karma.
Karma, it is related to karma, in, as you're saying, in other religions. But I don't think they equate it to the baggage of karma. They are equating that more with what they call samskaras, which is these habitual tendencies in Prakriti, because they don't have any notion of the psychic being. So it's habitual tendencies of Prakriti that continue to form a kind of a personality. So that
but, samskara is in the Prakriti level, and we also, Shravindu also talks about samskaras, no?
True.
So maybe they don't have an equivalent of the soul personality.
They don't. Now, one other point I wanted to make regarding what Keka asked about the Swabhava and Swadharma belonging to a single lifetime. As I said, being the soul's free choice, if it is the soul's free choice, it can change from lifetime to lifetime. And also, sometimes for several lifetimes, it may have the same and then change it in another lifetime. But I'd like to also add that if in fact the soul personality comes to the front, the psychic being comes to the front in a certain lifetime, then this idea of Swabhava and Swadharma does not need to hold one even in one lifetime. The Swabhava and Swadharma is actually related to the central being that is being used, so long as a certain lesson has to be learned so that the psychic being is using it in a hidden way in nature. But if it comes to the front, it can use it flexibly, and it is not dependent at all on using Swabhava and Swadharma in any determined manner through one lifetime even. This is partly the reason why in the integral yoga, the surrender is not made to any one of the four Mahashaktis, but to the Divine Mother herself. Because the Divine Mother can coordinate the actions of the expressions of the Shaktis and is not dependent on any specific Swabhava and Swadharma.
Very good. So basically we can say, if we can transcend this Swabhava and Swadharma, then that leaves us the door to live more than one lifetime within the same, with the same physical body.
Definitely.
Sitaram, you want to read the next paragraph?
But this aggregate is because of its composition, a heterogeneous compound not a single harmonious and homogeneous whole. This is the reason why there is a constant confusion and even a conflict in our members, which our mental reason and will are moved to control and harmonize and have often much difficulty in creating out of their confusion or conflict some kind of order and guidance. Even so, ordinarily we drift too much or are driven by the stream of our nature and act from whatever in it comes uppermost at the of the thought and action. Even our seemingly deliberate choice is more of an automatism than we imagine. Our coordination of our
Hello, Sitaram.
I think you dropped. I think both Keka and Sitaram have dropped. Their lines have dropped.
Oh. Hmm. Keka, Sitaram. Hmm.
Hello?
You can't sit down, doctor.
Hello, Debashita.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yes, yeah, sorry. I think Keka and Sitaram got briefly dropped out.
I see they both have returned. So.
Yeah.
Sita, you dropped off, you know, where you were saying that about the drifting, etc. You just drifted off yourself. Or you dropped off again.
No, he's there.
No, my thing says call dropped for Sitaram.
Oh. Oh, yeah, he's gray.
Yeah, so maybe one of us can continue and finish reading this?
Yeah, sure.
While we wait for Sitaram.
No, maybe somebody else can read it. Sitaram is having trouble, so
sure.
When he comes on, you know, later he can read.
Yeah.
So I can start. But this aggregate is, because of its composition, a heterogeneous compound, not a single harmonious and homogeneous whole. This is the reason why there is a constant confusion and even a conflict in our members, which our mental reason and will are moved to control and harmonize and have often much difficulty in creating out of their confusion or conflict some kind of order and guidance. Even so, ordinarily, We drift too much or are driven by the stream of our nature and act from whatever in it comes uppermost at the time and seizes the instruments of thought and action. Even our seemingly deliberate choice is more of an automatism than we imagine. Our coordination of our multifarious elements and of our consequent thoughts, feelings, impulses, actions by the reason and will is incomplete and half measure and a half measure. In animal being, nature acts by her own mental and vital intuitions. She works out an order by the compulsion of habit and instinct, which the animal implicitly obeys, so that the shiftings of its consciousness do not matter. But man cannot altogether act in the same way without forfeiting his prerogative of manhood. He cannot leave his being to be a chaos of instincts and impulses regulated by the automatism of nature. Mind has become conscious in him and is therefore self-compelled to make some attempt, however elementary in many, to see and control and in the end more and more perfectly harmonize the manifold components, the different and conflicting tendencies that seem to make up his surface being. He does succeed in setting up a sort of regulated chaos or ordered confusion in him, or at least succeeds in thinking that he is directing himself by his mind and will, even though in fact that direction is only partial, for not only a disparate consortium of habitual motive forces, but also newly emergent vital and physical tendencies and impulses, not always calculable or controllable, and many incoherent and inharmonious mental elements use his reason and will, enter into and determine his self-building, his nature development, his life action. Man is in his self a unique person, but he is also in his manifestation of self a multi-person. He will never succeed in being master of himself until the person imposes itself on his multi-personality and governs it. But this can only be imperfectly done by the surface mental will and reason. It can be perfectly done only if he goes within and finds whatever central being is by its predominant influence at the head of all his expression and action. In our inmost truth, it is his soul that is the central being, but in outer fact, it is often one or other of the part beings in him that rules. And this representative of the soul, this deputy self, he can mistake for the inmost soul principle.
So, in a way, exactly the drift of what we were discussing, he really brings out in this particular paragraph. Because what he's saying, the first part, he's making it very clear, that's really about the aggregate self, the multi-person as he's calling it, which is what our surface nature is. Surface nature is this multi-person to which we give a sense of being a united person due to two ends of our being. One is that our bodies are like an envelope that holds the whole together and gives us the appearance of being one person. Secondly, our minds tries to give a certain kind of an order because it carries within itself a sense of its own identity. That intelligence, the buddhi, the ego which is seated in the buddhi, gives that sense of, you know, being the I, being the person. Now, interestingly, this entire passage has very much resonance with postmodern thinking, which basically points exactly to this fact that the ego is only a tentative kind of anchor for something which is loose and drifting around like a bunch of debris held together by some force. It's just like, you know, like a comet, like dust, comet dust, which due to a certain kind of formation of gravity is spinning round and round a certain center. So, if that was the only case, then we would be actually in a very precarious condition. No possibility of unity. We could say that We are basically, you know, in a condition in which the mind make a foolish misidentification of itself as the source of our identity. But as a matter of fact, we are completely at the mercy of our own fragmentation. Now, social conventions may help that, because that's how Freud proceeds to talk about the fact that mankind, by being socialized, has a certain semblance of order to his life. And in his inner life, he has all kinds of resistances to that, and all kinds of neurosis and psychosis develop. But these can be kept under check by the will to be socialized, the will to be not maladjusted, but proper, just adjusted to social aims. But this is no real solution, because if the inner being is fragmented, then there can be no real justification for holding it together. It's just an illusion. Except for the fact that, of course, the experience of complete fragmentation is much more painful than even the illusion of unity. So here he is pointing to the fact that behind all this, there are two sources of unity. One source of unity, and these sources of unity belong to what he calls the central being. The first source of unity is one of these purushas, mental purusha, vital purusha, physical purusha, which is predominant in the being. However, that predominance is only a kind of, you know, subordination of the others, so to say, because of the superiority of one in the life. And also, it is not a freedom, but a relative freedom. One is, just as we were discussing earlier, conditioned to be a certain kind of expression, being an expression. But the true central being, as he's pointing out, is behind that in the psychic being. So to recognize this, this is the three levels, the level of nature's fragmentation into these multi-personality, the level of, and nature, mental prakriti trying to hold it together. Then behind it, one of the three purushas masquerading as the central being. And then behind that even, the true central being, which is the psychic being. So it's almost as if a whole hierarchy of towards origin has been pointed out. And this provides a certain kind of a yoga in the sense of a succession of identifications leading to the replacement of the fragmentation by the true source of unity.
Vibhashita, can you explain what fragmentation means?
Fragmentation is division, a broken condition, like you see, for example, the most primitive one is this triple, you know, break of matter, life and mind. So actually, you see, fragmentation, where does it arise from? This is the very, you know, at the basis of the evolution. The fragmentation arises from the mind principle, which essentially takes the one and splits it into the many. So now this splitting into the many has many different connotations to it. Primordially, it is the way by which the sacrifice of Purusha is effected, so that what we have, what we call matter, for example, is, you know, only appears to be a conglomerate of individual particles that otherwise are not held together by anything. You see, we can talk about things like gravity and all that, and electromagnetic force, but ultimately, particle by particle, the condition of materiality is one which is totally fragmented. See, that's why perhaps one of the visible expressions of matter that defines matter very appropriately as sand. So sand is like that, you know, it looks like it's all one thing. But ultimately it's grains that are completely separate and have nothing holding them together. So that is a condition of fragmentation. That could be called the condition or the appearance of the fragmentation or sacrifice of Purusha, where his infinity is totally granularized without any contact with one another. Now from that condition, if that is going to be the condition and will is given to each one of these particles, then we arrive at absolute chaos. That is, each particle has a will to do whatever it wants with nothing holding it to anything else. But if there is to be something holding them together, giving it a semblance of unity, then either something has to dominate and say, well, my will is greater than the rest of yours. Maybe for nothing else, for pragmatic reasons, you better obey me. See, that's what mind does. You see, he says, I'm the most intelligent of the lot, so you better obey me. And the others basically have to obey because they don't have enough power to they're marginalized, as it were. This is the condition of fragmentation. Underneath it, there has to be some unity whereby invisibly everything is aligned. That's the whole idea of the magnetic phenomenon. Magnetism aligns the disorganized, you know, tendencies of matter along a certain, you know, sort of direction.
So fragmentation is actually an experience of perception. So somebody who has gone above the creation, he may not see it as a fragmentation, but as a dance of harmony.
Yeah, seen from, say, the supramental point of view, undoubtedly it is a dance of harmony because nothing is undetermined. Everything is following exactly what the plan that it was supposed to follow. But at the same time, this kind of, you know, force which has been removed within the ignorance, within the avidya, the cohesive force has been withdrawn so that independence is given. Fragmentation is, from a certain point of view, the very condition of evolution. No evolution can take place unless there is fragmentation. Because by fragmentation, avidya gets the power to express in infinite forms the one who is infinite. But that oneness has to be recovered. The recovery of that oneness can only take place if each fragment in its will can experience the truth of its being to be the same truth that everything else has. The fragmentation cannot be overcome by agglomeration, by amalgamation. Fragmentation can only be overcome by arriving at a truth of oneness within fragment itself. That is the whole story of evolution. So that's why if we look at this picture in an even broader frame, if you look at Sri Aurobindo's projection of this individual situation to collectives, nations, and ultimately the whole world, you can see the same thing at work at every level. You know, it's like a fractal, you know, kind of description. Because that's why he's saying that there will be world union one day, but don't try to bring it about through dominating other nations by one nation, or to try to impose some single law which everybody has to follow. We have to form the confederation of nations that allows each nation to have its independence of will, but at the same time have the freedom to experience unity. Again, within the nation, the same thing again. The nation, so he's saying that there is a world soul, but we have to, every unit has to experience it. There is a national soul, but it doesn't do to just talk about it or to impose some nature law on everybody else. We all must be such and such. then we'll be expressing the national soul. Every fragmented entity in the nature has to experience it for itself. So it has to have the ability to have that experience. Similarly, as far as the human individual is concerned, mind, life and body each has to connect with the psychic being. Psychic being coming to the front is also related to mental, vital and physical adherence to the psychic. The personality has to lend itself, become receptive. On both sides, this thing has to happen.
So it is not enough that the central being becomes the mental purusha and that realizes the unity of the whole. Each fragment has to also reach its own fruition. That means the physical being also has to find its physical purusha and the vital being has to find its vital purusha.
Yeah, it's not so much the physical being has to, actually in Sri Aurobindo's terminology, being is Purusha. The physical being is the physical Purusha, the vital being is the vital Purusha, mental being is the mental Purusha, mental expression is mental Prakriti, etc. Now, the fragmentation that he's talking about on the surface is the surface Prakriti. Surface Prakriti has to first align itself to the Purushas. I'm using the word first has to align itself, but that's also a very relative way of speaking. Psychic being may come to the front at any point, but basically to bring about some kind of unity, I'm just rephrasing what you said, but I think the proper phrasing would be, the fragmentation of Prakriti has to align itself to each of the Purushas, and the Purushas themselves have to align themselves to the psychic being. So central being is something which ultimately can have control over the central aspect of the expression. And therefore, that aspect of the expression can become more coherent. But still, it is not the true central being. The true central being is the psychic being. The psychic being has to be brought into contact with the three principal Purushas and their respective Prakritis. Mental Purusha, Vital Purusha and Physical Purusha in and by themselves cannot control the others. And if we leave it at that, then we don't have an integral being. You'll have a lopsided being. So arrival at integrality means having some access to each of these. A direct access of each to the psyche. You know, this is actually a very important point because in psychology also, I'm talking about sort of psychotherapy, etc. It is recognized, the fact is recognized that there is a certain fragmentation of being. And greater the experience of fragmentation by a certain individual, the more pathological they become. So the idea is that society has created this fragmentation. So we must overcome this fragmentation by somehow creating some sort of linkage between mind, life and body and dominating it by the mind. See, that personality will solve the problem, so to say. But in our case, the problem is not solved like that. It is rather better to make them independent. Mind, life and vital can have an influence on each other, but should not have a rulership over each other. Rather, each one has to find its root in the psychic. Psychic can have rulership over all these three, mind, life and body. In fact, that's what he'll point out in the next paragraph.
Okay.
Where he say that essentially body in some way is like any material body and also like animal body. But human body is a little different from those bodies because it can respond to certain, you know, ideal impulses and essentially even express through the subtle physical some perfection. So to the vital, so to the mental. Why? Because each one of these had a contact with the psychic. And in empowering those contacts in itself, not through something else, but in its own self, the transformation can begin and also the psychic personality becomes stronger that way.
No.
The description of man, man's house, like where a butler answers, sometimes a watchman answers as the master. That analogy is very similar to what he is describing here, right?
Exactly. Very similar. Very, very similar. That first part was exactly like that. Driven by the stream of our nature, an act from whatever in it comes uppermost at the time and seizes the instruments of thought and action. Even our seemingly deliberate choice is more of an automatism than we imagine. Because we give a different kind of, you know, sort of accounting of ourselves to ourselves. A coordination of our multifarious elements and of our consequent thoughts, feeling, impulses, actions by the reason and will is incomplete and a half measure. I think Vince has some...
Let me try to get him. Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know how to get people in. Shyam, is there? How do we get Vince in?
Hang on.
That thing just goes away when I click. Those four people are gone.
Yeah, he should be here in a second.
He's showing as orange though.
It's okay, I think.
Yeah, he should come online in a second.
I think, let's go on to the next paragraph. It's very interesting. And I think it'll clarify even further what we are discussing.
Sitaram?
Sorry. I wanted to say something because my electrician came. This fragmentation, I mean, can we say that the word, hello?
Yes.
Fragmentation, can we say the word that is, how it is used is basically parts which are not united.
Yeah, absolutely. Parts which are separate and have independent will, that is fragmentation.
Yeah, but that is differentiation also, right? So, I don't know, like for example in the computer also the fragmentation we use like when we basically put the links together so that they are in the same areas. Like it is, if it is too much dispersed, then we say things are, memory is fragmented, for example.
Right. It is a kind of dispersion. It's a dispersion of substance. Of spiritual substance or quality, both quality and substance, in the sense that there is no connection between them. Now, connection is there because ultimately there is only one qualitative essence and only one substantial essence. But the connection has been withdrawn in appearance so that they can perceive themselves as infinite, different, fragmented, dispersed. So that dispersion has taken place only in a kind of an appearance. But underneath that, if the will is to really find its truth, how is it achieved? It's achieved by giving independence of will. Independence of will means that I can operate, I get the illusion that I can operate in a number of ways. But if instead of that I can find the truth of my being, I find that ultimately I am united with everything else.
So in daily life, we find fragmentation in ourselves in the fact that we have several desires that conflict and we have to sort them out and prioritize, or there is some needs of the body which conflicts with the needs of the mind, etc.
Yeah, exactly. That's what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out, that, you know, that basically, let's say we start with certain ideals that I would like to follow these principles. But that's only the mind's wish. At the same time, there are emotions, there are feelings, there are desires that have other kinds of wishes. And there is the body that has its own capacities, its own time, its own limits, its own cycles. So each one of these has its own disparate idea of things. Now, we give a certain account to ourselves, usually by the central being, that which is predominant. So let's say, if the ideal I put to myself is a vital one, I'm an ambitious person, I'm going to do from morning to night, I'm going to do whatever it takes to become successful, careerist, something of that kind, then we find that mental ideals have been subordinated, physical well-being has been subordinated, and these are kind of whimpering in the background somewhere. Or else, if they're strong enough, they're not whimpering, they're revolting. See? So that is, and then again, inside that, each of these, there's a variety of, wills again. Mind itself may have conflicting wills, even regarding the principles it wants to follow.
Mm-hmm. And the process of hearing it is not prioritizing them and keeping some of them quiet. It is basically letting each one realize the central unity.
Now, to say letting each one realize is not so easy ultimately, because you see, the thing is that if you just leave it to themselves, then, you know, it will, as he's saying, take many lifetimes, and in the meantime one might become completely, you know, non-functional. So you know, nature's way of actually using the mind or using the vital or whatever to create some semblance of unity is a practical step in the beginning. But what must be done, what he's pointing out, is that not each one of these conflicting wills, but mental prakriti itself, vital prakriti itself, physical prakriti itself, have to be brought into contact with some aspect of the Purusha. Either the Purusha has to be realized, or they have to be ultimately brought into contact with some aspect of the psychic in that nature. In other words, not that each fragmented part of the nature has to be allowed to find it, but by bringing psychic nature into contact with that aspect of nature, these will then get aligned. Some of them will be transformed, some of them will find their fulfillment, and some of them will drop off.
Mm. Yeah, that's the whole process of Shuddhi.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Sitaram, you want to read?
Yeah. Do you want to read, or should I? Can I read?
Yeah, actually, your paragraph was reread So you can start the next paragraph.
Okay. Actually, my Skype was down. Yeah, I'll keep. This rule of different selves in us is at the root of the stages of the development of human personality, which we have already had occasion to differentiate. And we can reconsider them now from the point of view of the government of the nature by the inner himself. In some human beings, it is the physical purusha, the being of body, who dominates the mind, will and action. There is then created the physical man mainly occupied with his corporeal life and habitual needs, impulses, life habits, mind habits, body habits, looking very little or not at all beyond that, subordinating and restricting possibilities to that narrow formation. But even in the physical man, there are other elements, and we cannot live altogether as human animals concerned with birth and death and appropriation and the satisfaction of common impulses and desires and maintenance of the life and the body. This is his normal type of personality, but it crosses, however feebly, with influences by which he can proceed if they are developed to a higher human evolution. If the inner satisfactory purusha insists, he can arrive at the idea of a finer, more beautiful and perfect physical life and hope or attempt to realize it in his own or in the collective or group existence. In others, it is the vital self, the being of life, who dominates and rules the mind, the will, the action. Then is created a vital man concerned with self-affirmation, self-aggrandizement, life enlargement, satisfaction of ambition and passion and impulse and desire, the claims of his ego, domination, power, excitement, battle and struggle, inner and outer adventure. All else is incidental or subordinated to this movement and building and expression of the vital ego. But still the vital man too, there are or can be other elements of the growing mental or spiritual character, even if these happen to be less developed than his life personality and life power. The nature of the vital man is more active, stronger and more mobile, more turbulent and chaotic, often to the point of being quite unregulated than that of the physical man who holds onto the soil and has a certain material poise and balance, but it is more kinetic and creative. But the element of the vital being is not earth but air. It has more movement, less status. A vigorous vital mind and will can grasp and govern the kinetic vital energy, but it is more by the forceful compulsion and constraint than by a harmonization of the being. If, however, a strong vital personality, mind and will can get the reasoning intelligence to give it a firm support, and be its minister, then a certain kind of forceful formation can be made, more or less balanced but always powerful, successful and effective, which can impose itself on the nature and environment and arrive at a strong self-affirmation in life and action. This is the second step of harmonized formulation possible in the essence of nature.
So here, Sri Aurobindo is looking at this entire problem from a developmental point of view. But in doing so, he's also looking at this possibility of the psychic in each of its terms. So first he's talking about, you know, there is a certain kind of, I mean, predominance of the physical life in some beings. There, one may say that the central being is the physical Purusha. In its normal or more natural manifestation, it is something which is very habitual, that is concentrated on the physical life. Even when he talks about the mind and vital existence, is basically tied to the physical life and its habits. Person is constantly concerned with material existence, and the life and mentality is completely, you know, swamped by that, see, from day to day. So that is one kind of person. But he's pointing out that that this is not all there is, that the possibility of even that has got some higher quality to it, because physicality can also start expressing a fineness, a beauty, a lightness, ideals of the form and of the capacity, both capacity, adaptability and form, which are not possible in a purely habitual concentration on the physical being. So what has happened there? Well, basically all that happened is that to the physical prakriti, there is a greater access to, in human beings, to some higher forces, whether they come from the mind or from the psychic being or from whatever. Physical Purusha can channel or can control physical prakriti and bring it into a certain mode. That's why you have, let's say, the ideal of the Greek body, which is what they say, a sound mind and a sound body, that the physical body has been, or the physical life, not just the body, it's actually the culture of the body, the physical culture, has been geared to expressing a ideal which is related to reason. You know, the mental ideal, the body, is actually like a extension of the idealism of the mind. Now, similarly, you find in the Indian case, at least as far as the art goes, a similar physical ideal is being expressed, where rather a certain kind of spiritual proportion and harmony, something related to a much, higher type of humanity, is being made available as a physical ideal. Now, how do these physical ideals manifest, or how do they even come into the imagination? They come through the agency of the physical Purusha, which has lent itself to something else. Physical Purusha itself is controlling the physical prakriti and giving it a certain form under the impetus of some kind of a higher, inspiration, you may say. That inspiration may be mental, the inspiration may be spiritual, the inspiration may be psychic. Similarly, he says that at a higher level of development, it's the vital life. The physical life has got a certain stability to it because it maintains itself within certain limits. But the vital life is free-flowing and, as he says, belongs to the element of air and, you know, is driven by kineticism, dynamic property. And so it moves towards the affirmation of tremendous violences that can otherwise totally overcome and shake the life of the body. And so we find that those are the excesses of the vital life. But he points out again that the vital can also have its own ideals. A regulated vital life, an expressive, creative vital life, a creative vital life which is brought under limits either through the vital Purusha lending itself to the mental Purusha or lending itself to the spiritual or to the psychic. And he points out that would be a higher formation if the vital prakriti can find that power of the Purusha to act with inspiration through it. I think Keka has dropped off.
Yeah, she's not online. So, you know what, in the Kena Upanishad, that story about, you know, the last story where there's this Yaksha, and first Jataveda goes to seize it and he cannot, and then Vayu goes as Matarishwan and he too cannot, and then the mind seizes it.
Yeah.
This has a parallel to this, right?
Yes, yes, it does have a parallel. Mm-hmm. It does have a parallel.
And also you mentioned that the Jataveda. But there, of course, you told it as the psychic being. Yeah.
Here, of course, the Upanishad, the Kena Upanishad, which is being used as the fiery principle,
mm-hmm.
see, which is actually being related to matter over there.
Mm-hmm.
And the vital principle is being related to Vayu.
Mm. Or Matarishwan. Or the mother element.
Yeah.
Mm. I think I was just reading, he said, Jataveda is related to matter because it is anything that is born. And since matter is that which is born.
That's right.
So it is the Jataveda.
Jataveda is Agni, right?
Yes.
Many suttas start with the Jataveda.
Yes.
The common.
Because Agni is the priest.
Yeah. Jataveda, Sanava, that is the Durga Sutta starts with Jataveda. Jataveda is Srinava Masava Mariti Yata Veda Sana, something like that it goes.
Actually Durga herself is called Vairochani. No, Virochana is the fire. So the Shakti of fire. No, Virochana is fire.
I did not know that actually.
Sitaram, isn't Vairochana fire?
I thought it is Surya, but I think.
Vairochani, that is Durga's name. Incidentally, it is also the name of one of the five Buddhas, no? Celestial Buddhas.
Yeah. Not one of the five, he is the Supreme Buddha.
Oh,
Vairochana is above the other four Dhyani Buddhas?
Yeah. He is the source.
But above that, there is the Transcendental Buddha.
The Transcendental Buddha is Vairochana.
Oh.
It is the same as what they call one of the Kayas, Dharma Kaya.
Does it have any relationship with... Oh, we are not sure if Vairochana means fire. Mm.
But that kind of Buddhism that you just mentioned, actually that mantra you mentioned also comes out of that, you know, the same kind of, Vairochana Buddhism also has the mantra. That's the origin of the mantra, I believe, that you mentioned, Om Mani Padme Hum. That is a very interesting, that whole lineage, I think it is definitely very close to an integral idea.
Are you talking of the Tantric Buddhism?
Tantric Buddhism is an offshoot of this whole thing. Tantric Buddhism has kept in the Tantric form this entire Vairochana cult alive. But Vairochana was not necessarily tied to the tantric system.
Okay, so it came up with separately from Mahayana Buddhism.
From Mahayana, yeah.
Uh-huh.
There's one sutra for the Avatamsaka Sutra. That is the origin of this particular idea. Avatamsaka Sutra is a Mahayana Sutra.
Particular idea means the idea of Om Mani Padme Hum?
No, of Vairochana.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, guys.
Yeah. Shall we read another paragraph?
Yeah, we can read one more.
Uh-huh.
English, but I think it will give a good completion to what we're studying.
Deka, you want to read this? It is at a higher stage of the evolution. Page
899. Okay. Sorry, I don't know if I disturbed you guys with some noise or something.
No, it was fine.
No, I think you just got cut out.
Yeah. At a higher stage of the evolution of personality, the being of mind may rule. There is then created the mental man who lives predominantly in the mind as the others live in the vital or the physical nature. One second. I'm sorry. Mental man tends to subordinate to his mental self-expression, mental aims, mental interests, or to a mental idea or ideal, mental idea or ideal, the rest of his being. Because of the difficulty of this subordination and its potent effect when achieved, it is at once more difficult for him and easier to arrive at a harmony of his nature. It is easier because the mental will, once in control, can convince by the power of the reasoning intelligence, and at the same time dominate, compress or suppress the life and body and their demands, arrange and harmonize them, force them to be its instruments, even reduce them to a minimum so that they shall not disturb the mental life or pull it down from its ideative or idealizing movement. It is more difficult because life and body are the first powers, and if they are not in the least strong, can impose themselves with an almost irresistible insistence on the mental ruler. Man is a mental being, and the mind is the leader of his life and body. But this is a leader who is much led by his followers and has sometimes no other will than what they impose on him. Mind, in spite of its power, is often impotent before the inconscient and subconscient, which obscure its clarity and carry it away on the tide of instinct or impulse. In spite of its clarity, it is fooled by vital and emotional suggestions into giving sanction to ignorance and error, to wrong thought and to wrong action, or it is obliged to look on while the nature follows what it knows to be wrong, dangerous or evil. Even when it is strong and clear and dominant, mind, though it imposes a considerable mentalized harmony, cannot integrate the whole being and nature. These harmonizations by an inferior control are, besides, inconclusive, because it is one part of nature which dominates and fulfills itself, while others are coerced and denied their fullness. There can be steps on the way, but not final. Therefore, in most men, there is no such soul dominance and effected partial harmony, but only a predominance, and for the rest an unstable equilibrium of a personality half formed, half in formation, sometimes a disequilibrium or unbalance due to the lack of central government or the disturbance of a formerly achieved partial poise. All must be transitional until a first, though not final, true harmonization is achieved by finding out real center. For the true central being is the soul. But this being stands back, and in most human natures is only the secret witness, or one might say a constitutional ruler, which allows his ministers to rule for him, delegates to them his empire, silently assents to their decisions, and only now and then puts in a word which they can at any moment override and act otherwise. But this is so long as the soul personality put forward by the psychic entity is not yet sufficiently developed. When this is strong enough for the inner entity to impose itself through it, then the soul can come forward and control the nature. It is by the coming forward of this true monarch and his taking up of the reins of government that there can take place a real harmonization of our being and our life.
So we can see how accurately Sri Aurobindo has described this life of the mind and of the unstable kind of harmony, as he said, unstable equilibrium, a personality half formed, half in formation, that he has drawn, this picture that he has drawn is so accurate, you know, it's amazing in its accuracy. Even that the distinctions he makes about the power of mind to control, that man is a mental being and the mind is the leader of his life and body. But this is a leader who is much led by his followers and sometimes has no other will than what they impose on him. Mind, in spite of its power, is often impotent before the inconscient and subconscient, which obscure its clarity and carry it away on the tide of instinct and impulse. So sometimes the mind is obscure, then at other times it may be clear. In spite of its clarity, it is fooled by vital and emotional suggestions. So depending on the kind of nature, each of these other parts of the nature have their own kind of way to dominate the mind. The subconscious and the inconscient can obscure the mind. The vital can fool the mind. It's fooled by the vital and emotional suggestion into giving sanction to ignorance and error. They trick it. They make it their ally, you see, to wrong thought and to wrong action. And then even worse, sometimes it cannot be made fool, but it has no power. It is impotent. It just watches like a fool while the other things do what they want. Or it is obliged to look on while the nature follows what it knows to be wrong, dangerous or evil. So this is the precarious condition of mind as the leader. Prana, Sharira, Neta. You know, the Neta, the leader of the life and the body. See, you know, this picture he paints is just so absolutely accurate, you know. And then this thing about the unstable equilibrium, that all human beings have a level, that kind of an invisible fulcrum. And if you just push that fulcrum, they just disintegrate into insanity. See, everybody has a certain level of, you know, upstanding sanity and control and balance, but a certain level that they themselves have no control over, where they slip into total absurd insanity. And this is not just one or two people, but this is the human lot. This is the point that he's making over here. And because we don't want to acknowledge it, because we don't have any other power to bring into its, you know, remedy. And so even as far as psychology is concerned, we'd rather hold to the idea that, no, we have control. some form or the other, we can maintain control over the whole nature. Maybe if we can't, then there's something wrong with us and we need to go into psychotherapy. Some other person is going to help us to develop that harmony which we lack ourselves. But the point he's making is over here that all that that points to is the fact that there is something lacking, and that which is lacking has to come to the front. That cannot come to the front until it is strong enough. And it cannot be strong enough, in a sense, until the inner nature doesn't give it its own adherence. So it's that relationship that has to be developed. Each of these parts must find it in themselves to relate to the psychic being, to give it its surrender, so that the psychic can come to the front, grow strong, impose itself on the mind, life and body, and develop a personality which can bring unity to the system. So that's why he's saying over here, this is so as long as the soul personality put forward by the psychic entity is not yet sufficiently developed. When this is strong enough for the inner entity to impose itself through it, then the soul can come forward and control the nature. And by the coming forward of this true monarch and his taking up of the reins of government, that they can take place a real harmonization of our being and life.
No, Debashista, this thing about the monarch is reminding me of the song by Tagore. Moharajo eki shaje ele hidayo purmaje, charano tale ko kishoshi, shurjo more laje.
Yeah.
No, that song is very nicely sung by Debabrata Bishash.
Yeah, it's very evocative. Mm. Truly talking about the psychic being.
Mm-hmm. So, Sitaram, what it means in the translation is, Mr. Tagore is telling that, hey king, at last you have come within me. I mean, what kind of way you have come. I see you such that a crore of moons are under your feet and the sun is dying of shame looking at your effulgence.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
There was something similar. I mean, there was one poet called Karunashri. He wrote a lot about Lata and Buddha. And he has he wrote 5 cantos on Buddha. And one of them is wrote similar type of thing. Like he says, you finally came and basically I don't have enough water to give oxygen to you. And he says, like, I offered my ears to you, and like, I don't have chairs in my house. And he very, very poetically he puts.
Mm-hmm. I was seeing the meaning of Vairochana. Vairochana means anything that is bright and effulgent. So this is the name of the sun, the moon, the fire. Ruchi.
Yeah, Ruch, right, Ruch. Exactly.
Yeah.
Shining. Roshana. That's why even in modern vernaculars, in Hindi, Roshan means the sunlight or the moonlight. Light, basically.
Roshni.
Roshni.
Mm.
Or Roshan. Roshana is to shine.
This chapter, Memory, Ego and Self-Experience, chapter 8, in book 1, part 2. That one talks a lot about this mental being and its ignorance and all that, like, you know, how this we identify with the mental becoming. That one I just thought of mentioning. That chapter is really good, very powerful.
Shall we end here with a short meditation?